In this podcast brought to you by the Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Office, we look at advocacy on mining and extractive industries in Africa.
Thank you for inviting me. I feel very honored to be speaking to this esteemed group. I particularly value the work that Catholic bishops play in society. And as a development worker, I just want to highlight one role that I resonate with, thus being the voice for the voiceless. And I'm particularly pleased to have faith-based organizations involved in climate change advocacy. So thank you very much. I'm supposed to speak. I hope you can hear me. You can just press the like button to show that you are hearing me. I'm supposed to speak on the process of transition towards sustainable clean economies in the mining sector and extractive industries. Let me say the whole world is moving towards low carbon and climate resilient economies. And what does that mean? It means reducing greenhouse gas emissions from whatever we do, starting even from household level. And what's the key sector when we are talking climate change, the key sector that emits the most is the energy sector. And how does mining sector come in? Mining sector uses lots of energy. I can, in informal way, call them energy guzzlers. So it's important to talk about mining. And maybe let me say, in this case, let me start with the importance of minerals in green transition. You know that for the energy sector, we are moving away, for example, from coal towards renewable energy sources, and that includes wind, solar, geothermal, and of course it involves the storage. So we use minerals in these technologies, wind, solar, geothermal, and of course the storage, and electric vehicles, for example, to name a few, the key technologies. So what are we saying? Africa is endowed with these minerals. We know that. Today I really want to focus more on lithium, because lithium is the bottleneck. Some of you who might have heard that President Biden, the U.S., and a climate change bill that was approved. Most of what's in there is electric vehicles. And there's no way we can manufacture electric vehicles or storage of energy without lithium. So yes, all these other metals and minerals I've mentioned are very important. And for example, 70% of cobalt is in Africa, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, as most of you might know. But let me go back to lithium. Lithium, there is going to be a scramble for lithium, which raises questions. We know the negative impacts of mining activities, and lithium is no exception. We have, for example, what are the negative environmental impacts of traditional methods of lithium extraction? Lithium extraction uses lots of water, evaporation. More like evaporation ponds, It also causes ground destabilization, increased salinity of our rivers, contamination of our soils, and toxic waste. Let me not just dwell on in the environment, but mining operations, we know very well that they displace communities. So displacement of local communities is again a key issue that we have to take into account, being a community, like I said, that speaks for the voiceless. Lithium deposits, where are they found? The highest lithium deposits are found in Latin America, Chile, for example, but also in Australia, so Argentina, China. In Africa, where do we find lithium reserves? The DRC, Mali, and in Southern Africa, Zimbabwe actually has the highest lithium reserves. Like I said, there is going to be a scramble for lithium. And right now, what's happening, I have told you of the negative impacts of lithium extraction. There is ongoing research and development activity to look at technologies that, for example, use less water. And I'm sure you've seen on the news U.S. companies, for example, that are testing these new technologies in Latin America, like, for example, in Argentina. But there are still doubts whether these will work. I mean, if you do something in the laboratory and then you test in the field, the results may be different. So we know, of course, the labor issues that are involved with mining activities, the human rights issues. For example, I'm sure all of us we have read about child labor in cobalt mining in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the human rights abuses, and of course the health and safety standards. I was talking of the pollution of our freshwater sources. So what can Africa do? How can Africa benefit? In fact, before I go there, I forgot to mention that we are moving away from fossil fuel, right? Let's look at Southern Africa, coal. So we are moving away from coal. Can you imagine what will happen to Witbank? I've forgotten the new name for Witbank. Amalahleni? What will happen to that town if we move away from coal? What will happen to those people's lives and livelihoods? Because Witbank is built around a coal economy. So that's why I'm sure you've heard about the term just transition. So we have, as we transition to renewable energy, to clean economies, we have to take that into consideration. People should not lose their lives and livelihoods. And if there's a need for maybe reskilling, alternative livelihoods, then that should be done. And we need proper job assessments, proper modeling of green jobs that the new technologies will bring. So again, let me go back to what Africa should do. You find that who is going to do this extraction? It's mainly mining conglomerates from rich countries. They have the technology. They have the capital. And how does Africa benefit? In Southern Africa, how is Zimbabwe going to benefit? That's a key question. And then what happens to the local communities? Because it's land-based mining. Shall we start thinking of value addition? Because the tendency in Africa is to export raw materials. It could just be coffee. But Ethiopian coffee, you find it in Starbucks, maybe rebranded. Cocoa from Africa, you find it in Switzerland as chocolate, rebranded, and of course of a higher value. So we are saying, how can we have mineral value addition? How can we move just from exporting raw lithium? Because there is a huge market. In fact, a World Bank report says that the demand, I said I'm focusing more on lithium, the demand for lithium is going to jump maybe 50 times between now and 2040 or 2050. So there is going to be scramble for lithium. We need capacity for negotiation capacity, because private sector is going to be heavily involved. I mean, governments alone do not have the capital and the technology. So how do governments how will they be capacitated to have that ability to negotiate win-win contracts so that their economies benefit, so that their local communities benefit? We also need strong legal and regulatory frameworks. Otherwise, we end up with not just environmental, but like I said, labor, health and safety, human rights. We have to look at all that. Then we also have to look at governance issues in Africa, corruption. Will that not create a loophole that will disadvantage our communities and our economies? And we do not have, we need to invest more into research and development. So redirecting our finance, it could be our budgets, towards research and development so that we find local solutions. And then I talked about reskilling. There's a large skill gap. So how can we reskill our people so that they effectively participate? Let me go to the flip side of this argument and say that the mining companies themselves are also affected by climate change. So they have to prepare themselves to adapt or to mitigate. I said they use lots of energy. So it means switching again their traditional energy sources so that they emit less. And indeed, a lot is happening. If we look at big companies in our region, like Anglo-American, they do produce a climate. You can find it. It's open information. You can Google it. So they are already doing a lot in terms of looking at their energy sources. Extreme weather events do affect them. In terms of, let's say, if it's open cast mining, the flooding that happens if we have excess storm water, for example, the roads, the access roads to mines may again be affected by extreme weather events. So that's the other side of the coin. Mining companies also have to take that into account. And there are lots of sustainability initiatives. Companies are beginning to, they are becoming very serious serious in terms of greening their business strategy as well as their operations. I've talked a lot, maybe you may think it's just high grade minerals, but I'm sure you've seen pavements. For example, we are trying to make sure that there is not much runoff when we have storm water. And we are using, I'm sure you've seen it, I've seen it in Johannesburg, for example, and some other cities, where you put stones so that the storm water can infiltrate into the soil, and that causes less flooding of our streets. So that, again, I consider it as an extractive industry, because you have to get those stones from somewhere, and it surely has an impact. Again, let me go to what's happening in the world. There is a talk about deep sea mining. These minerals that I've been talking about, because most likely land-based mining will exhaust the minerals. These are non-renewable resources. So now they are looking at deep sea mining, and there are concerns. You can get the same minerals I was talking about, copper, cobalt, zinc, from the seabed. But as most of you might know, environmentalists and environment organizations such as Greenpeace are fighting against this, because up to now we don't really know the impact of this to marine ecosystems. But most likely the marine ecosystems will be disturbed. And what happens to the blue economy? We have our people that depend on fishing, for example. What happens to those communities? So I think let me end at that. Thank you very much, and back to you, facilitator. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that. We will park questions and comments for afterwards. That being said, apologies, I forgot to introduce the speakers or request that they introduce themselves. I think it's because of our start. It was very hush-hush. So I'm going to humbly request that Doreen introduces herself, because I might say things about her that are not actually what she wants people to know, Peter John would always say. So over to you, Doreen.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be here today. Thank you. Thanks so much for the invitation. And that was a great introduction from Daisy. And I, Daisy, I learned so much. So really, really happy to be here. I'm Doreen Stubinsky. I'm a professor of global environmental politics at College of the Atlantic in the United States. And I'm not at all a mining expert. I work in the area of climate change and the relationship that intersections with climate change and biodiversity. So in talking to you today, I hope I'm able to bring some more general ideas into the conversation that might be useful in your work. In particular, what can we learn about from the actions that many NGOs call false solutions? So let me start. I'm trying to figure out how to read my notes and see the project the
do you
project
need,
things at the same time. Okay. I'm going to share my screen and let's see if I can start this. Do you see that okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So, yeah, let's see if I can make these slides move. So unmasking false climate solutions in mining and related industries. And to start, I thought, you know, to put the phrase false climate solutions in context, it might be useful to ask, well, what are actually real climate solutions? If NGOs, if non-governmental organizations and civil society are calling attention to these false solutions, when they think about false solutions, they also have a discourse about real solutions. And thinking about that with respect to climate change, it's reducing our emissions, it's moving societies away from dependence on fossil fuels. They are also looking at solutions that help to bring carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is what's leading to climate change. And, you know, some of the new technologies that Daisy's talked about in terms of batteries dependent on lithium, those are certainly renewable energy technologies are certainly real solutions to climate change. But I should also add that in the discourse of non-governmental organizations, in the work of non-governmental organizations, equity and justice are also really important, really central frames. You know, Daisy talked about the displacement of communities, labor and human rights issues, and real solutions really need to have equity and justice embedded in them. It's not just a real solution to climate change isn't large numbers of electric vehicles in the United States based on batteries that are made with lithium from the African continent and without paying attention to energy poverty, energy injustice, energy, and the places where lithium is taken from. So that said, that's sort of the set of real solutions or a way to think about the real solutions that are obviously about false solutions. But NGOs have quite active campaigns against what they call false solutions. Okay, what do those look like? Well, what might be the point of false solutions? One phrase that NGOs use is dangerous distractions. That is, false solutions are those solutions that distract us away from real solutions, that make us focus in one direction and not think about, for example, reducing emissions or an energy transformation there instead of that. Why are they false? They look green, but they either provide a greenwash or a smokescreen for continued harm. They have their own impacts or both. So that's how I'd start to talking about false solutions. I'm just looking at my notes here, and I might actually turn off the video. And what I did there. Okay. So in talking about false solutions, I wanted to use two examples. These are two examples in areas that I work closely, carbon offsets I work with closely, biodiversity offsets, not so much. There are other examples of false solutions. So, for example, we can think about the area of geoengineering, but I'm going to focus on carbon offsets and biodiversity offsets. And so the first question to ask is what's an offset? An offset is where you, in very general terms, a bad plus a good, you add them together and there's no net impact. It means that the bad continues to happen, but you add some good to it, and the idea is that the good balances out the bad. I can go into more technical details. I wanted to keep this at a very general level, but in the Q&A, we can certainly explore further. A carbon offset, then, in the climate change context, is where someone is increasing their emissions. They're continuing to emit carbon dioxide. Somebody else in some other place is either reducing their emissions or they're actually bringing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. You'll notice, those of you who have are more involved in the climate change debate, you might recognize that it doesn't developing more renewable energy doesn't offset the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Those emissions by investing in renewable energy. It's not technically an atmospheric offset. There's no balancing out, as this balance seems to be.
We seem to be.
And you'll also notice at the bottom there. Sorry?
There seems to be a bit of a connection issue on your side. We didn't hear the last two seconds or so. It keeps going on and off on your audio.
I'm so sorry about that. Have I effectively turned off my video? I tried to turn off.
I've done that for you on my part.
Okay.
Help a bit with the bandwidth.
Okay. I am. Can you tell me, are you seeing my PowerPoint or are you seeing the whole PowerPoint or are you seeing just the slide?
I'm seeing the entire PowerPoint.
Let me just try
also,
to start
this
again.
Also, I can hear you better now, so you can continue. It sounds a whole lot better. Thank you.
Well, let me just say the last couple of points that I made about this slide because you missed it. That you can see carbon offset valued in dollar terms, right? A carbon offset is that's marketable. That's marketized. That's commodified. There are it in another, and that the bad and the good add up. And the term that's used in those discussions is no net loss. There's no net loss of biodiversity. I think it's useful to ask the question of whether or not you can actually add up biodiversity. That said, that taking the lead from carbon markets, carbon offsets, biodiversity offsets have been created. To do that, we have to turn carbon and nature into commodities. Offsets function through markets. The idea is that you use the market to find the place where the least expensive actions can happen, right? So it's very, expensive for a coal-fired power plant in the United States to transition. Oh, the idea is that, well, you just pay someone else somewhere in probably a developing country to take some action, and that in theory should offset the bad. Similarly, you know, a company carrying on emitting or destroying biodiversity would pay someone else to do something good. And that, of course, begs the question of how do you do that, right? Because you can't see carbon dioxide. How do you measure biodiversity, right? What is being valued? What value do you place on nature, on ecosystems? What gets bought, what gets sold, and what price? At what price, and who gets to determine the price, right? I wanted to use one case study, and this is a case study. It's not so familiar to me, but it's the case study that came up when I was looking for information about biodiversity offsets and mining in the African region. And this is a case study in Madagascar, Rio Tinto, and their local affiliate, QIT Madagascar Minerals, is working on the coast of Madagascar on ilmenite extraction, and this was a pilot project where. In the case of this ilmenite mining, ilmenite extraction, the idea was to find some other place sort of similar with a forest that could be preserved and to do kind of a trade so that they destroy the forest with ilmenite extraction and some other forest, the Sitangambarika Forest, gets preserved. The consequence, and this is, you know, obviously a very missing the adjective, but it's a very illustrative and perhaps exaggerated impact of. A biodiversity offset, but the forest that was chosen for the offset was there was one forest chosen about 50 kilometers north and then another forest of 230 kilometers north. And in the case of a biodiversity offset, right, you need to protect the ideas. You protect forest in one place while you destroy it somewhere else. The practice of this biodiversity offsetting, which was facilitated by a local conservation organization that is affiliated with IUCN and BirdLife International and Wildlife Conservation Society and Conservation International, was to keep the villagers of Antsotso from using the forest. The forest was identified, was cordoned off. Villagers were no longer allowed to go into the forest and take down trees in order to build their boats, in order to fish. They were no longer able to use the forest and areas at the edge of the forest for cultivation of cassava. The conservation group told them to go grow some cassava by the coast and sandy soils where the cassava didn't grow. And the biodiversity offset was created through an exclusionary approach, an idea that people and biodiversity conservation are incompatible. If you are destroying biodiversity in one place to save biodiversity in another place, you have to make sure that it is actually using that biodiversity, that it is pristine, and that because you have to be able in some way to count, right? I mean, how do you value biodiversity? Maybe it's species, number of species. Maybe it's special ecosystems. But the idea is that you have to have some way to show to the world that you're preserving biodiversity, that there's no net loss of biodiversity. which, you know, all of these approaches raise these profound questions of justice and equity. And I've just got some questions here, but I think they're the ones that non-governmental organizations and civil society and indigenous peoples and local communities raise with respect to these, you know, what they call these false solutions of biodiversity offsets. The question is whose biodiversity is it to buy and sell? Who gets to decide that it's that forest outside the village of Antsotso that is going to be the forest that's going to be preserved, and that the mining company gets to destroy? Like, who says that mining company gets to destroy the forest that it's destroying? Whose lives and livelihoods get protected? And Daisy raised these issues, right? Is it the lives and livelihoods of villagers, or is it the lives and livelihoods of the transnational mining corporation? For example, what values are taken into consideration and which are ignored? We have to value biodiversity in some way, right, in order to put a dollar value on it. But does that leave aside, and how are the values of things, of spiritual values, of food and medicine for local populations, of livelihoods of local populations, which get to be included? Who gets to be involved in the decision making around all of this? Whose way of life takes precedence? And I go back to the, you know, this question about lithium and electric vehicles in the United States, or, you know, in the case of carbon offsets, you know, a major use of carbon offsets from forest preservation activities in the global south is for airline customers in the global north, right? Who buys carbon offsets? It's people, and I have included here a Delta Airlines slogan. Now you don't have to choose between seeing the world and saving the world. You can buy your plane ticket, see the world, add a few dollars onto the price of your plane ticket, which buy some carbon offsets for you in the global south, and then you don't actually have to feel guilty about flying. I mean, this is the utility. I would say you still have to feel guilty about flying, but this is how carbon offsets are used in the global north. So whose way of life takes precedence? It's the folks who have money and extra money to buy carbon offsets that end up determining the use or the protection of forests in the global south, that get to decide that the villages of Antsotso may not actually have access to their forests anymore because of the guilt that customers in the global north might want to assuage. I wanted to add, and this is, I can send along the citation for this and actually the paper itself. It's a different way of thinking about biodiversity and people. It's, many of the authors are Southern African authors. Of the global negotiations under the Convention on Biological Diversity, but it's articulated perspective. This is published in the journal Science, shared approach, an approach which looks at people and nature together, their resources. About the fact that our nature is not your solution, that forest offsets and carbon markets aren't a solution. I'll wrap up with some more general comments about some of the struggles at the international level. And a quote that I found recently, which I thought was, it just spoke to me about some of the discourse right now in the climate space, particularly around false solutions, that the great enemy of clear language is insincerity. When there's a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns to long words and exhausted idioms like a cuttlefish spitting out ink. I like that visual. But in the case of false solutions, it may not so much be long words and exhausted idioms, but there are definitely new phrases that are created in order to obscure what's actually going on. We have these vaguely green sounding claims like nature positive, carbon neutral, nature-based solutions, and they're useful, right? Those vague sounding, green sounding claims are useful for a company like Shell, for example, to promote itself as supporting nature-based solutions. They, you know, their solutions are continue driving your car in the Netherlands, but you can, according to Shell, you can drive carbon neutrally because they're planting a bunch of trees. So all you have to do is pay just a few pennies more for your petrol, and they've got you covered. Don't worry about it because they've got nature-based solutions because they're planting trees and otherwise investing in forest preservation around the planet. Right. In the case of biodiversity, there's a new term out there called nature positive. I had already introduced this idea of no net loss. We don't have a net loss. We actually have some sort of net gain. The devil, of course, is in details of, you know, what does that look like at the local level? And so let me just end by, you know, coming back to the title of the presentation, Unmasking False Solutions. You know, how do we do that? It requires looking behind the claims. It requires looking at who are the interests that are involved. Those are interests of polluters, but I would also add, in general, the global elites and the lifestyles of the global elites that offsetting and other false solutions are meant to preserve. Unmasking false solutions requires us to look at the concrete impacts on lives and livelihoods of the most vulnerable. I'll also say, going back to one of the phrases that I started with, this idea of dangerous distractions, what are the real solutions that people are, you know, that companies are afraid to talk about? What are the real solutions that are being avoided? Solutions that are actually about stopping emissions, actually are about the energy transformation, and solutions that are not just about the energy transformation, but that are about a just and an equitable transformation, as Daisy mentioned when she told us about just transition approaches. So that's my presentation for you this morning, and I'm really looking forward to your questions and further conversation.
Thanks for listening. Please remember to subscribe at cplo.org.za.